Midnight. Completely exhausted. Surely it's not normal to be revising before a date as if it were a job interview. Suspect Daniel's enormously well-read brain may turn out to be something of a nuisance if things develop. Since leaving work, I have nearly slipped a disc, wheezing through a step aerobics class, scratched my naked body for 7 minutes with a stiff brush, cleaned the flat, filled the fridge, plucked my eyebrows, skimmed the papers and the ultimate sex guide, put the washing in and waxed my own legs, since it was too late to book an appointment. Ended up kneeling on a towel trying to pull off a wax strip firmly stuck to the back of my calf while watching Newsnight in an effort to drum up some interesting opinions about things. Wise people will say Daniel should like me just as I am. But I am a child of cosmopolitan culture, have been traumatized by supermodels and too many quizzes, and know that neither my personality nor my body is up to it if left to its own devices. Saturday, 25th of February, 6 p.m. Oh, joy! Have spent the day in a state I can only describe as shag drunkenness, mooning about the flat, smiling, picking things up and putting them down again. Oh, it was so lovely. The only down points were, one, immediately it was over, Daniel said, "Damn, I meant to take the car into the Citroën garage." And two, when I got up to go to the bathroom, he pointed out that I had a pair of tights stuck to the back of my calf. But as the rosy clouds begin to disperse, I begin to feel alarm. What now? 11 p.m. Oh, God. Why hasn't Daniel rung? Are we going out now or what? March. Saturday, 4th of March. I am so depressed. Daniel, though flirty all week, has given me no hint as to what is going on between us, as though it is perfectly normal to sleep with one of your colleagues and then just leave it at that. At 4:15 on Friday evening, Sharon rang me in the office. "Are you coming out with me and Jude tomorrow?" I silently panicked, thinking, surely Daniel will ask to see me this weekend before he leaves the office. "Call me if he doesn't ask," said Sharon dryly after a pause. At 5:45, saw Daniel with his coat on heading out of the door. My traumatized expression must have shamed even him, because he smiled shiftily, nodded at the computer screen and shot out. Sure enough, message pending was flashing. Message Jones. "Have a good weekend. Pip, pip. Cleve." Miserably, I picked up the phone and dialed Sharon. "What time are we meeting tomorrow?" I mumbled sheepishly. 8:30. Café Rouge. "Don't worry, we love you." 2 a.m. "I had a real relief with Shaz and Jude. Daniel's stupid prat. Feels sicky, though." Oops. Sunday, 5th of March, 8 a.m. Ugh. Wish was dead. I'm never ever going to drink again for the rest of life. 11:30 a.m. Badly need water, but seems better to keep eyes closed and head stationary on pillow so as not to disturb bits of machinery and pheasants in head. Noon. Bloody good fun, but V-confused, re-advice, re-Daniel. Had to go through Jude's problems with Vile Rich at first, as clearly they are more serious, since they have been going out for 18 months rather than just shagged once. I waited humbly, therefore, till it was my turn to recount the latest Daniel instalment. The unanimous initial verdict was bastard fuckwittage. Interestingly, however, Jude introduced the concept of boy time, as introduced in the film Clueless, namely 5 days. 7. I interjected, during which new relationship is left hanging in air after sex, does not seem agonizing lifetime to males of species, but a normal cooling down period in which to gather emotions before proceeding. Anyway, going to have another little sleep. 2 p.m. Story in papers about 2-year-olds having to take tests to get into nursery school just made me jump out of my skin. Oh, I'm supposed to be at a tea party for godson Harry's birthday. 6 p.m. Drove at breakneck speed, feeling like I was dying across grey, rain-sodden London to Magda's, stopping at Waterstones for birthday gifts. Magda, once a commodity broker, lies about Harry's age now to make him seem more advanced than he is. Even the conception was cutthroat, with Magda trying to take 8 times as much folic acid and minerals as anyone else. The birth was great. She'd been telling everyone for months it was going to be a natural childbirth, and 10 minutes in, she cracked and started yelling, "Give me the drugs, you fat cow!" Tea party was nightmare scenario. Me plus a room full of power mothers, one of whom had a 4-week-old baby. "Oh, isn't he sweet?" cooed Sarah Delisle, then snapped, "How did he do in his Apgar?" This Apgar is a test they have to do at 2 minutes. Magda embarrassed herself 2 years ago by boasting at a dinner party that Harry got 10 in his, at which one of the other guests, who happens to be a nurse, pointed out that the Apgar test only goes up to 9. Thought head was going to burst with the racket. Eventually made my excuses and drove home, congratulating myself on being single. Called Tom to report the hideous news that Daniel had not rung all weekend. Tom said I should not flirt, not lecture, but merely be an aloof, coolly professional ice queen. Men, he claims, view themselves as permanently on some sort of sexual ladder with all women, either above them or below them. If the woman is below, i.e. willing to sleep with him, then in a Groucho Marx kind of way, he does not want to be a member of her club. This whole mentality depresses me enormously. But Tom said not to be naive, and if I really love Daniel and want to win his heart, I have to ignore him and be as cold and distant to him as possible. Monday, 6th of March. Can officially confirm that the way to a man's heart these days is not through beauty, food, sex, or alluringness of character, but merely the ability to seem not very interested in him. Took no notice of Daniel whatsoever all day at work, and pretended to be busy. Try not to laugh. Eventually, when Perpetua was out, he walked past my desk, stopped for a moment, and murmured, "Jones, you gorgeous creature, why are you ignoring me?" The heavens were smiling on me, and the phone rang. I rolled my eyes apologetically, picked it up. Then Perpetua bustled up, knocking a pile of proofs off the desk with her bottom and bellowed, "Ah, Daniel, now!" And swept him away, which was fortunate because the phone call was Tom, who said I had to keep up the Ice Queen act and gave me a mantra to repeat whenever I felt myself weakening. Aloof, unavailable Ice Queen. Aloof, unavailable Ice Queen. Wednesday, 15th of March. Have woken up fed up. On top of everything, only 2 weeks to go until birthday, when we'll have to face up to the fact that another entire year has gone by, during which everyone else except me has mutated into smug married, having children plop, 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 left, right and centre, and making hundreds of thousands of pounds and inroads into very hub of establishment, while I career rudderless and boyfriendless through dysfunctional relationships and professional stagnation. Also worried about how to celebrate birthday. Size of flat and bank balance prohibits actual party. Maybe dinner party? Could all go out for meal, but then feel guilty asking everyone to pay, selfishly presuming to force costly and dull evening on others merely to celebrate own birthday. Oh, God, what to do? Friday, 17th of March. Have decided we'll have dinner party. Just called Tom, who says, very wisely, "It is your birthday and you should invite exactly and only who you want." So, I'm just going to ask the following. Sharon, Jude, Tom, Magda and Jeremy. Called Tom back to tell him the plan and he said, "And Jerome?" "What?" "And Jerome." I thought, like we said, I just ask who I tailed off, realising if I said wanted, it would mean I didn't want, i.e. like, Tom's insufferable pretentious boyfriend. "Oh," I said, overcompensating madly, "you mean you're Jerome. Of course Jerome's invited, you ninny. Ugh. But do you think it's okay not to ask Jude's vile Richard and Wony, even though she had me to her birthday last week? She'll never know. When I told Jude who was coming, she said perkily, "Oh, so we're bringing other halves," which means vile Richard. Next thing, Sharon rang. "I hope I haven't put my foot in it. I just saw Rebecca and asked her if she was coming to your birthday, and she looked really offended." Oh, no. I'll have to ask Rebecca and Martin Crashing Bore now. But that means I'll have to ask Joanna as well. Shit! Shit! Now I've said I'm cooking, I can't suddenly announce we're going out to a restaurant, or I'll seem both idle and mean. Oh, God. Just got home to icy, offended-sounding answer phone message from Woni. "Cosmo and I were wondering what you'd like for your birthday this year. Would you call us back, please?" Realise I'm going to spend my birthday cooking food for 16 people. Saturday, 18th of March. 2 p.m. Just what I needed. My mother burst into my flat. "Guess what, darling?" she said, dropping her eyes modestly, then looking up, beaming like Bonnie Langford about to embark upon a tap dancing routine. "What?" I muttered grumpily. "I got a job as a TV presenter." Sunday, 19th of March. Hooray! Whole new positive perspective on birthday. Have been talking to Jude about books she has been reading, about festivals and rites of passage and primitive cultures, and I'm feeling happy and serene. Realise it is shallow and wrong to feel that flat is too small to entertain 16, and that cannot be asked to spend birthday cooking, and would rather dress up and be taken to posh restaurant by sex god with enormous gold credit card. Instead, I'm going to think of my friends as a huge, warm African, or possibly Turkish, family. These 16 people are my friends. They want to be welcomed into my home to celebrate with affection and simple homely fare, not to judge. I'm going to cook shepherd's pie for them all. It will be a marvellous, warm, third-world-style ethnic family party. Monday, 20th of March. Have decided to serve the shepherd's pie with char-grilled Belgian endive salad, roquefort lardon, and frizzled chorizo to add a fashionable touch. Have not tried before, but sure it will be easy. Followed by individual Grand Marnier soufflés. Tuesday, 21st of March. Birthday. 6:30 p.m. Cannot go on. Have just stepped in a pan of mashed potato, forgetting that kitchen floor and surfaces were covered in pounds of mince and mashed potato. It is already 6:30 and have to go out to Cullen's for Grand Marnier soufflé ingredients and other forgotten items. Oh, my God. Suddenly remember tube of contraceptive jelly might be on side of wash basin. Must hide it. 7:35 p.m. Oh, my God! Just looked for milk and realised I've left the carrier bag behind in the shop. That means, oh, God, and the olive oil. So can I do frizzy salad thing? 7:40 p.m. Best plan, surely, is to get into the bath with a glass of champagne, then get ready. At least if I look nice, I can carry on cooking when everyone is here, and maybe can get Tom to go out for the missing ingredients. 7:55 p.m. Doorbell. I'm in bra and pants with wet hair. Suddenly hate the guests. I've had to slay for 2 days, and now they were all swanning, demanding food like cuckoos. Feel like opening door and shouting, "Oh, go fuck yourselves." 2 a.m. Feeling V-emotional. At door were Magda, Tom, Sharon and Jude with bottle of champagne. They said to hurry up and get ready, and when I had dried hair and dressed, they had cleaned up all the kitchen and thrown away the shepherd's pie. It turned out Magda had booked a big table at 192 and told everyone to go there instead of my flat. And there they all were, waiting with presents, planning to buy me dinner. Love the friends. Better than extended Turkish family in weird headscarves any day. April. Sunday, 2nd of April. I read in an article that Kathleen Tynan, late wife of the late Kenneth, had inner poise, and, when writing, was to be found immaculately dressed, sitting at a small table in the centre of the room, sipping at a glass of chilled white wine. Kathleen Tynan would not, when late with the press release for Perpetua, lie fully dressed and terrified under the duvet, chain-smoking, glugging cold sake out of a beaker, and putting on makeup as a hysterical displacement activity. Kathleen Tynan would not allow Daniel to sleep with her whenever he felt like it, but not be her boyfriend. nor would she become insensible with drink and be sick. Wish to be like Kathleen Tynan, though not, obviously, dead. Inner poise. No fags for 6 days now. Have assumed air of dignified hauteur with Daniel and not messaged, flirted, or slept with him for 3 weeks. Only 3 alcohol units consumed over the last week as grudging concession to Tom, who complained that spending the evening with the new vice-free me was like going out for dinner with a whelk, scallop, or other flaccid sea creature. My body is a temple. I wonder if it's time to go to bed yet. Oh no, it's only 8:30. Ooh, telephone. 9 p.m. It was my father, speaking in a weird, disconnected voice. Bridget, turn your television set to BBC One. I switched channels and lurched in horror. It was a trailer for the Anne and Nick show, and there, between Anne and Nick on the sofa, was my mother, all boofed and made up as if she were Katie Bloody Boyle or someone. And we'll be introducing our new springtime slot, said Nick. Suddenly single, a dilemma being faced by a growing number of women. Anne. And introducing spanking new presenter, Pam Jones, said Anne. Suddenly single herself and making her TV debut. Wednesday, 5th of April. Told Jew today about the inner poise thing, and she said, interestingly, that she'd been reading a self-help book about Zen. She said that it was all a question of flow rather than struggle, and if, for example, you had a problem or things were not working out, instead of straining or becoming angry, you should just relax and feel your way into the flow, and everything would work out. But not to mention idea to Sharon, because she thought it was bollocks. Thursday, 6th of April. Went to meet Jude for quiet drink to talk about flow some more, and noticed a familiar besuited figure with knitting pattern, dark good looks, sitting in a quiet corner, having dinner. It was Magda's Jeremy. Waved at him, and just for a split second saw expression of horror cross his face, which instantly made me look to his companion, who was A, not Magda, and B, not yet 30. I could tell Jeremy was going to try to get away with a sort of quick, hello, not now look, which acknowledges your close, old and enduring friendship, but at the same time demonstrates that this is not the moment to affirm it with kisses and an in-depth chat. I was about to play along with it, but then I thought, hang on a minute. Sisters. Under the skin. Magda. I altered my path to pass his table, at which he immersed himself deep in conversation with the trollop, glancing up as I walked past and giving me a firm, confident smile as if to say, business meeting. What should I do now, though? Oh, dear, oh, dear. Tell Magda? Not tell Magda? Mind my own business? Remembering Zen, Kathleen Tynan and inner poise, I centred myself, concentrating on the inner wheel till the flow came. Then I resolved serenely to tell no one, as gossip is a virulent, spreading poison. Tuesday, 11th of April. All seems normal with Magda and Jeremy, so maybe it was just a business meeting. I'm invited to a glittering literati launch of Kafka's motorbike next week at the Ivy. Determined, I'm going to improve social skills, confidence, and make parties work for me, as guided by article I've just read in magazine. Apparently, Tina Brown of the New Yorker is brilliant at dealing with parties, gliding effortlessly from group to group, saying, Martin Amis, Nelson Mandela, Richard Gere, in a tone which at once suggests, my God, I have never been more enchanted to see anyone in my entire life. Wished to be like Tina Brown, though not, obviously, quite so hard-working. The article is full of useful tips. When introducing people, add a thoughtful detail or two about each person so that their interlocutor has a conversational kicking-off point, e.g. This is Gina. She's a keen skydiver and lives on a barge. Tuesday, 18th of April. Party got off to a bad start. Found myself a drink, then spotted Perpetua talking to James from the Telegraph. Approached Perpetua confidently, ready to swing into action, but instead of saying, "James, Bridget comes from Northamptonshire and is a keen gymnast. I'm going to start going to gym again soon," she just carried on talking, well beyond the 2-minute mark, and ignored me. I hung around for a while, feeling a total git, then spotted Simon from marketing, cunningly pretending I had not intended to join Perpetua's conversation at all. I bore down purposely on Simon, preparing to say, "Simon Barnett," in the style of Tina Brown. When I was almost there, however, I noticed that, unfortunately, Simon from marketing was talking to Julian Barnes. Suspecting that I might not be able to fully pull off crying, "Simon Barnett, Julian Barnes," with quite the required gaiety and tone, I hovered indecisively and started to sidle away, at which point Simon said in an irritated superior voice, "One you, funnily enough, never hear him use when he's trying to get off with you by the photocopier. Did you want something, Bridget?" "Ah, yes," I said, panicking wildly about what it was I could possibly want. "Yes?" Simon and Julian Barnes looked at me expectantly. "Do you know where the toilets are?" I blurted. Damn! Damn! Why did I say that? I saw a faint smile hover over the thin but attractive lips of Julian Barnes. Actually, I think they're over there," I said, and made for the exit. Afterwards, I breathed in deeply through my nose, murmured "inner poise," and pushed through the doors back into the party. Perpetua was still by the door, talking to her ghastly friends, Piggy and Arabella.
"I have to say, I think it's disgraceful. All it means in this day and age is that a whole generation of people only get to know the great works of literature, Austen, Eliot, Dickens, Shakespeare, and so on, through the television."
"Well, quite. It's absurd. Criminal."
"Absolutely. They think that what they see when they're channel-hopping between Noel's house party and Blind Date actually is Austen or Eliot."
"Blind Date is on Saturdays," I said.
"I'm sorry?" said Perpetua.
"Saturdays. Blind Date is on Saturdays at 7:15.
"So?"
said Perpetua, sneerily. "Those big adaptations don't tend to go out on Saturday nights."
"Oh, look, there's Mark," interrupted Piggy.
"Oh, God, yeah," said Arabella beadily. "He's left his wife, hasn't he?" What I meant was, there isn't anything good like Blind Date on the other side during the literary masterpieces, so I don't think that many people would be channel-hopping.
"Oh, Blind Date is good, is it?" sneered Perpetua.
"Yes, it's very good."
"And you do realise Middlemarch was originally a book, Bridget, don't you? Not a soap."
I hate Perpetua when she gets like this, stupid old fart-ass bag. "Oh, I thought it was a soap of a shampoo," I said sulkily, grabbing a handful of passing satay sticks and shoving them into my mouth. As I looked up, I saw a dark-haired man in a suit straight in front of me. "Hello, Bridget," he said. I nearly opened my mouth and let all the satay sticks fall straight out. It was Mark Darcy, but without the Frank Boff-style diamond pattern sweater. "Hello," I said through my mouthful, trying not to panic. Then, remembering the article, I turned towards Perpetua. "Mark, Perpetua is..." I began, and then paused, frozen. What to say? Perpetua is very fat and spends her whole time bossing me around. Mark is very rich and has a cruel, raced ex-wife. "Yes," said Mark. "Is my boss and is buying a flat in Fulham. And Mark is," I said, turning desperately to Perpetua, "a top human rights lawyer."
"We were just talking about hierarchy of culture," boomed Perpetua. "Bridget is one of those people who thinks the moment when the screen goes back on Blind Date is on a par with Othello's 'Hurl my soul from heaven' soliloquy," she said, hooting with laughter.
"Ah, then Bridget is clearly a top postmodernist," said Mark Darcy. "This is Natasha," he said, gesturing towards a tall, thin, glamorous girl beside him. "Natasha is a top family law barrister." I had the feeling he was taking the piss out of me, bloody cheek. "I must say," said Natasha with a knowing smile, I always feel with the classics, people should be made to prove they've read the book before they're allowed to watch the television version.
Oh, I quite agree, said Perpetua, emitting further gales of laughter.
They should have refused to let anyone listen to the World Cup tune, hooted Arabella, until they could prove they had listened to Turandot all the way through. Though in many respects, of course, said Mark's Natasha, suddenly earnest, as if concerned the conversation was going quite the wrong way. The democratization of our culture is a good thing.
Except in the case of Mr. Blobby, who should have been punctured at birth, shrieked Perpetua.
As I glanced involuntarily at Perpetua's bottom, thinking, well, that's a bit rich coming from her, I caught Mark Darcy doing the same thing. What I resent, though... Natasha was looking all sort of twitchy and distorted, as if she were in an Oxbridge debating society. Is this sort of arrogant individualism, which imagines each new generation can somehow create the world afresh. But that's exactly what they do, said Mark Darcy gently. What I mean is, if you're taking that sort of cutesy, morally relativistic, blind date is brilliant sort of line, she said with a resentful look in my direction. I wasn't. I just really like blind date, I said. I can't stand gladiators, though. Makes me feel fat, I said. Anyway, nice to meet you. Bye. I was just standing waiting for my coat, reflecting on how much difference the presence or absence of a diamond-patterned sweater can make to someone's attractiveness, when I felt hands lightly on my waist. I turned round. Daniel! Jones, what are you doing skulking off so early? He leaned over and kissed me. You smell nice. Then offered me a cigarette. No, thank you. I have found inner poise and given up smoking, I said, wishing Daniel wasn't quite so attractive when you found yourself alone with him. I see, he smirked. Inner poise, eh? Yes, I said primly. Have you been at the party? I didn't see you. I know you didn't. I saw you, though, talking to Mark Darcy. How do you know Mark Darcy? I said, astonished. Cambridge. Can't stand the stupid nerd. How do you know him? He's Malcolm and Elaine Darcy's son, I began. Who in the... They're friends of my parents. I used to play with him in the paddling pool. Yes, I bet you did, you dirty little bitch, he growled. Do you want to come and have supper? Inner poise, I told myself. Inner poise. Come on, Bridge, he said, leaning towards me seductively. I need to have a serious discussion about your blouse. It's extremely thin. Almost, when you examine it, thin to the point of transparency. Has it ever occurred to you that your blouse might be suffering from bulimia? I've got to meet someone, I whispered desperately. Come on, Bridge. No, I said, with a firmness that rather surprised me. Shame, he said softly. See you Monday. And gave me a look so dirty I felt like throwing myself after him, shouting, Shag me! Shag me! Saturday, 22nd of April. Today is an historic and joyous day. After 18 years of trying to get down to 8 stone 7, I have finally achieved it. It is no trick of the scales, but confirmed by genes. I am thin. There is no reliable explanation. I have been to the gym twice in the last week, but that, though rare, is not freakish. I have eaten normally. It is a miracle, rang Tom, who asked, Are you in love? In a suspicious, jealous tone. He's always like this. If you're single, the last thing you want is your best friend forming a functional relationship with somebody else. I racked my brains, then stopped, shocked by a sudden, stunning realization. I am not in love with Daniel anymore. Friday, 28th of April. At 8:45 last night, I was running a relaxing aromatherapy bath and sipping chamomile tea when a car burglar alarm started up. I have been waging a campaign in our street against car burglar alarms, which are intolerable and counterproductive, since you are more likely to get your car broken into by an angry neighbour trying to silence the burglar alarm than by a burglar. The doorbell rang.
I picked up the intercom. A V-posh sheep voice bleated, "He's having a fucking affair!" Then there was hysterical sobbing. I rushed downstairs where Magda was outside the flat in floods of tears, fiddling under the steering wheel of Jeremy's Saab convertible, which was emitting a doo-ee, doo-ee, doo-ee of indescribable loudness, all lights flashing, while the baby screamed as if being murdered by a domestic cat in the car seat. "Turn it off!" somebody yelled from an upstairs window. "I bloody well can't!" shrieked Magda, tugging at the car bonnet. "Jeremy!" she yelled into the portable phone. "Jerez, you fucking adulterous bastard! How'd you open the bonnet of the Saab?" Magda is very posh. Our street is not very posh. It is of the kind which still has posters in the window saying, "Free Nelson Mandela." Magda and I were both in the car now, pulling any lever we could find. Magda swigging intermittently at a bottle of Laurent Perrier. By this time, an angry mob was gathering. Next thing, Jeremy roared up in his Harley Davidson. But instead of turning off the alarm, he started trying to grab the baby out of the back seat with Magda screaming at him. Then the Australian guy, Dan, who lives below me, opened his window. "Oi, Bridget," he shouted. "There's water pouring through my ceiling." Shit! The bath! I ran upstairs, but when I got to my door, I realised I'd shut it behind me with the key inside. I started banging my head against it, yelling, "Shit! Shit!" Then Dan appeared in the hall. "Christ," he said. "You'd better have one of these." "Thanks," I said, practically eating the proffered fag. Several cigarettes and a lot of fiddling with the credit card later, we were in, to find water flooding everywhere. We couldn't turn the taps off. Dan rushed downstairs, returning with a spanner and a bottle of scotch. He managed to turn off the taps and started helping me to mop up. Then the burglar alarm stopped, and we rushed to the window just in time to see the Saab roar off, with the Harley Davidson in hot pursuit. We both started laughing. We'd had quite a lot of whiskey by now. Then suddenly, I don't quite know how, he was kissing me. This was quite an awkward situation, etiquette-wise, because I had just flooded his flat and ruined his evening, so I didn't want to seem ungrateful. Then suddenly a man in motorbike leathers appeared at the open door, holding a pizza box. "Oh, shit," said Dan. "I forgot I ordered pizza." So we ate the pizza and had a bottle of wine and a few more cigarettes and some more scotch. And then he restarted trying to kiss me, and I slurred, "No, no, you mustn't." At which point he went all funny and started muttering, "Oh, Christ, oh, Christ." "What is it?" I said. "I'm married," he said. "But Bridget, I think I love you." When he'd finally gone, I slumped on the floor, shaking, with my back to the front door, chain-smoking butt ends. Then the doorbell rang. I ignored it. Then it rang without stopping. I picked it up.
"Darling,"
said a different drunken voice I recognised. "Go away, Daniel," I hissed.
"No, let me explain."
"No.
Ridge, I want to come in."
Silence. Oh, God, why do I still fancy Daniel so much?
"I love you, Ridge."
"Go away. You're drunk," I said, with more conviction than I felt.
"Jones?"
"What?"
"Can I use your toilet?"
Saturday, 29th of April. 22 hours, 4 pizzas, 1 Indian takeaway, 3 packets of cigarettes and 3 bottles of champagne later, Daniel is still here. I am in love. I am also now between one and all of the following. A. Back on 30 a day. B. Engaged. C. Stupid. D. Pregnant. 11:45 p.m. Have just been sick. And as I slumped over the loo trying to do it quietly so Daniel wouldn't hear, he suddenly yelled out from the bedroom.
"There goes your inner poise, my plumptious. Best place for it, I say."
May. Monday, 1st of May. I seriously think I am pregnant. Daniel and I were so carried away with euphoria at being back together again that reality seemed to go out of the window. And once you've... Oh, look, I don't want to talk about it. Oh, dear. I'm starting to get carried away with the idea of self as Calvin Klein-style mother figure, Poss wearing crop top or throwing baby in the air, laughing fulfilledly in advert for designer gas cooker, feel-good movie or similar. Next, I discovered a whole new world of Daniel fantasies. Daniel carrying the baby in a sling, Daniel rushing home from work, thrilled to find the two of us pink and glowing in the bath. But then Daniel appeared. I have never seen him look worse. The only possible explanation was that on leaving me yesterday, he had carried on drinking. He looked over at me, briefly, with the expression of an axe murderer. Suddenly, the fantasies were replaced by images from the film Barfly, where the couple spend the whole time blind drunk, screaming and throwing bottles at each other. Or Harry Enfield's The Slobs, with Daniel yelling, "Bridge! The baby is bawling its head off!" And me retorting, "Daniel, I'm having a fag!" Thursday, 4th of May. Went to the chemist to discreetly buy a pregnancy test. I was just shoving the packet at the girl on the till, with my head down, wishing I'd thought to put my ring on my wedding finger, when the chemist yelled, "You want a pregnancy test?" "Shh!" I hissed, looking over my shoulder. "How late's your period?" he bellowed. "You'd be better with the blue one. It tells you if you're pregnant on the first day after your period is due." I grabbed the proffered blue one, handed over the £8 sodding 95 and scuttled out. For the first 2 hours this morning, I kept staring at my handbag as if it was an unexploded bomb. At 11:30, I could stand it no longer, grabbed the handbag, got in the lift and went to the loo's 2 floors down to avoid the risk of anyone I knew hearing suspicious rustling. For 3 minutes, I didn't look at it. There was no way I was going to watch my fate being sealed by a slowly forming thin blue line. Then I picked up the stick and nearly screamed. There in the little window was a fine blue line. Oh, oh! I bolted and went out to a phone booth to ring Sharon. "Jesus! I'll meet you in Café Rouge in 15 minutes, she said. Although it was only 12:45, I thought a vodka and orange wouldn't do any harm since it was a genuine emergency. But then I remembered that baby wasn't supposed to have vodka. I waited, feeling like a weird sort of hermaphrodite or push-me-pull-you. On the one hand, I was all nesty and gooey about Daniel, smug about being a real woman, so irrepressibly fecund. On the other, I was thinking, oh my God, life is over. Daniel is a mad alcoholic and will kill me, then chuck me when he finds out. No more sex, bottles of wine and fags. No one will fancy me, and I will not fit into any of my trousers, particularly my brand new acid green Agnes B jeans. When Sharon arrived, I sulkily thrust the pregnancy test with its telltale blue line at her under the table. "Is this it?" she said. "Well, of course it is," I muttered. "You," she said, "are a ridiculous human being. Didn't you read the instructions? There are supposed to be 2 lines. This line is just to show the test is working. 1 line means you're not pregnant, you ninny." Saturday, 6th of May. VE Day. 7 p.m. The heat has made my body double in size, I swear. I am never going into a communal changing room again. I got a dress stuck under my arms in warehouse while trying to lift it off, and ended up lurching around with inside-out fabric instead of a head, tugging at it with my arms in the air, rippling stomach and thighs on full display to the assembled sniggering 15-year-olds. Maybe I should ring Tom and get a lovely party together for Bank Holiday Monday. Is it possible to have kitsch, ironic VE Day party, like for the royal wedding? No, you see, you can't be ironic about dead people. Oh well, time for a little drink. Daniel will be here soon. Best start preparations. 11:59 p.m. Blimey. Hiding in kitchen having a fag. Daniel is asleep. Actually, I think he's pretending to be asleep. Completely weird evening. Realise that our entire relationship so far
has been based on the idea that one or other of us is supposed to be resisting having sex. Spending an evening together when the idea was that we were supposed to have sex at the end of it was nothing short of bizarre. When it was getting impossible to avoid the subject of bedtime any longer, we went all formal and English. Instead of tearing each other's clothes off like beasts, we stood there going, "Do use the bathroom first." "No, after you." "No, no, I won't hear of it." If there is a God, I would like to humbly ask him, whilst making it clear that I'm deeply grateful for his suddenly turning Daniel inexplicably into a regular feature after so much fuckwittage, to stop him getting into bed at night wearing pyjamas and reading glasses, staring at a book for 25 minutes, then switching off the light and turning over, and turn him back into the naked, lust-crazed sex beast I used to know and love. June. Saturday the 3rd of June. Finding it impossible to concentrate on almost anything in the heat, except fantasies about going on mini-breaks with Daniel. Head is filled with visions of us lying in reeds by rivers, me in long white floaty dress, Daniel and I sitting outside ancient Cornish waterside pub, sipping pints in matching striped T-shirts, and watching the sun set over the sea. Daniel and I eating candlelit dinners in historic country house hotel courtyards, then retiring to our room to shag all hot summer night. Sunday, 4th of June, 7 p.m. Daniel has just gone home. Bit fed up, actually. Was really lovely hot Sunday, but Daniel did not want to go out or discuss mini breaks, and insisted on spending all afternoon with the curtains drawn, watching the cricket. God, it's hot. Quite like leaning out of the window. Someone is playing a saxophone in an effort to pretend we are all in a film set in New York, and can hear voices all around because everyone's windows are open. Can smell cooking from restaurants. We'll just ring Tom, then get down to work. 8 p.m. I'm just going round to Tom's for a quick drink, just for half an hour. Sunday, 11th of June. Another wasted Sunday. It seems the entire summer is doomed to be spent watching the cricket with the curtains drawn. Sunday, the 18th of June. After sitting in semi-darkness for the third weekend running, with Daniel's hand down my bra, fiddling with my nipple as if it were a sort of worry bead, and me occasionally feebly saying, "Was that a run?" I suddenly blurted out, "Why can't we go on a mini break? Why? "That's a good idea," said Daniel mildly, taking his hand out of my dress. "Why don't you book somewhere for next weekend? Nice country house hotel. I'll pay." Sunday, 25th of June. Oh, dear. Daniel decided Wovingham Hall was nouveau from the moment we arrived, because there were three Rolls Royces parked outside, and one of them yellow. I was fighting a sinking realization that it was suddenly freezing cold, and I had packed for 90 degrees heat. This was my packing. Swimsuits 2, bikinis 1, long floaty white dress 1, sundress 1, trailer park trash pink jelly mules 1 pair, tea rose pink suede mini dress 1, black silk teddy, bras, pants, stockings, suspenders, various. 5:30 p.m. Instead of lying side by side with Daniel in hot sun at the side of the lake wearing a long floaty dress, I ended up blue with cold in a rowing boat with one of the hotel bath towels wrapped around me. Eventually, we gave up to retire to our room for a hot bath and codice. As I emerged from my bath, Daniel was lying on the bed giggling. "I've got a new diet for you," he said. "So you do think I'm fat?" "Okay, this is it. It's very simple. All you do is not eat any food which you have to pay for. So at the start of the diet, you're a bit porky and no one asks you out to dinner. Then you lose weight and get a bit leggy and shag me hippie, and people start taking you out for meals. So then you put a few pounds on. The invitations tail off and you start losing weight again." "Daniel!" I exploded.
That's the most appalling, sexist, fattest, cynical thing I've ever heard. Oh, don't be like that, Bridge, he said. It's the logical extension of what you really think. I keep telling you nobody wants legs like a stick insect. They want a bottom they can park a bike in and balance a pint of beer on. I'll just pop the telly on, said Daniel, taking advantage of my temporary speechlessness to press the remote control button, and moving towards the curtains, which were those thick hotel ones with blackout lining. Seconds later, the room was in complete darkness apart from the flickering light of the cricket. Daniel had lit a fag and was calling down to room service for 6 cans of Foster's. Do you want anything, Bridge? He said, smirking. Cream tea, maybe? I'll pay.